This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 21st of June 2015, here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 311 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme, we'll be taking a closer look at Monocle's home city of London, but not the one we know today. Interactive historian Dr. Matthew Green will be here to discuss the city's past and the strange characters who've helped to make it all work. Well, just about, anyway.
We'll also hear from Christian Felber, the Austrian activist and academic, trying to make the world a little fairer. He'll be discussing his ideas for an economy that serves the common good a little later on.
And Monocle's contributor in Helsinki, Katja Pantsa, will be joining us later to shed light on the Finnish capital and why light itself in Finland is one of the area's most evocative qualities.
That's all to come. Plus, Monocle's Daniel Jacopelli will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll enjoy a Sunday tune or two right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So, another week, Tom Edwards, and it's me and you, not Andrew and Rob.
They're having a breather. They got their feet up somewhere. I don't know what they're doing. Don't know what they're up to.
I think Rob is still somewhere in Thailand.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. On his holiday. Sorry, commission. Important commission.
Stevie gets very upset if you make those kind of allusions.
I know. But hopefully he won't be able to hear it because he'll be somewhere in Chiang Mai for The Escapist.
And there's a lot of actual reporting trips and things happening, aren't there, for that?
So yeah, yeah. We've dispatched editors and writers all across
the globe. What are you most looking forward to reading about, hearing about?
I am...
Got a bit... Maybe it is Rob's Chiang Mai.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, so Rob's Chiang Mai thing, I'm really looking forward to. Also, there's a few other things. I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to...
So we can't give the game away.
I can't give the game away. What I can give the game away on, is happy to talk about, is, of course, the July-August issue, which has been out now for a little bit, for a few days. Subscribers will have had it for a little bit longer. It's a weighty old thing, isn't it?
It's hefty. I just wonder, Steve, the sort of quality of life ratings. People have probably digested it now. What are we, you know, a week or two on? But you tend to get quite a lot of...
Abuse?
What should I describe it? Fan mail slash abuse.
Abuse.
What's been... Have anything's really struck you that people have said that maybe, I don't know, inform your thoughts for future editions and so on and so forth?
The Danes are not particularly happy because Copenhagen's dropped from number one. They've been... Yeah, there's been a lot of sort of... Not angry Danes, sad Danes. It's even worse. They're like, we've dropped. Oh, there's been a lot of that. There was the Italians have also been a little bit. What's the best way of describing it? They're a bit annoyed. They don't quite understand why none of the Italian cities made it into top 25. There was one piece I read a few days ago which talked about how Palermo should be in the top 25, but then said, whatever you do, don't mention the M word, sing the Godfather tune, or ask too many questions.
Rather, you one suspects, thereby answering the question of why is Palermo not featured on the set.
Yes, indeed. But no, on the whole, it's been pretty positive, and there's been, you know, a lot of good feedback, as you'd expect for a quality of life survey. Still no Birmingham on the list. I'm working on that.
That could be a while, though, Steve.
It might.
I'm looking forward, speaking of great cities, to talk a little bit later to Matthew Green, who's taken us on a time travel tour through this great city of ours.
Indeed.
It's exciting, isn't it?
Indeed. Regular listeners to The Urbanist, of which there are, I'm sure, many, may well know Matthew Green because he's done these little... he does these audio tours around London. I know that Andrew Tuck has been on a couple with him down the years. Looking forward to him. We're also, as we said before, we're going to be in Helsinki as well. Number 8 on Quality of Life.
Absolutely.
I should just mention that. But before all of that...
Which I'm looking forward to.
Of course.
All of those things.
Of course. But I think you're going to be especially looking forward to the first thing.
No, because I already feel like I'm not going to be looking forward to this.
Really?
If it's what I think it is.
Well, because, you know, you're in your seats, so you can't do the news look ahead. I'm in this seat, so I can't do the news look ahead.
Oh, no, that can only mean one thing.
We could have gone to Canada to ask Thomas Lewis to do it, but it didn't really go well last time. So let's bring in Mr. Daniel Jacopelli.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day.
quite right. There is no other than Danny,
mercifully.
Sadly. We looked for others and we couldn't find any. So it is Daniel Jacopelli here with the news look ahead.
I love that song.
Can I just say I don't love Danny more each day. I think the feeling that I have is...
I love the song more and more each day.
Some kind of hatred. Something like that.
Anyway, I'm sure Danny is here to wow us with his news knowledge of the upcoming 7 days, including today. Danny, where are we going?
Well, the 200th anniversary of Napoleon Bonaparte's defeat at Waterloo. How about we start with that?
I was wondering where you were going as you started laughing to introduce what's traditionally the serious
part of the news look ahead. I was going to say Waterloo we're going to, but we're not going to Waterloo. All across London today, in fact, all across the country, the battle will be celebrated.
I don't think it will be,
There'll be a reenactment of the historical moment that news of the British and Allied forces reached London.
And that was, of course, a really interesting story, which we heard about on The Weekly a few weeks ago, how that news actually got back. And it was not how you might imagine it.
That's, of course, why I just said it.
Was it not carrier pigeon?
It was an incredibly slow process. The news actually, it travelled essentially at a walking, literally a walking pace. You could have, if you just set off, Steve, you would have got there at the same time. It's an incredible journey.
A horse-drawn post chase will travel from Old Royal Naval College in Greenwich to St. James Square.
And there's other things that are interesting. You know, the Belgians have minted a 2.5 euro coin.
The French aren't happy about that at all.
Indeed.
Their French cousins across the border, yeah.
A very odd moment of French, of Belgian levity. Yeah.
And you know how we're marketing here on Monocle 24?
How?
We are sending someone, and it could be you, Danny, to St. Helena. And you just get to stay there.
You get to, yeah. But you're basically
forever.
Being exiled.
I think we
once... We're gonna exile you to St. Helena.
Can we exile a member of staff? I'm hearing that we can.
Didn't we send Adrian Craddock there a few years ago?
No, we did actually send Anne-Marie Gardner, was original New York bureau chief, America's bureau chief, when Monocle began in 2007. We once... And you know, this sounds like it was punishment, but she was up for it. We stuck her on a mail ship for 12 days that sailed... from Cape Town, I believe, sort of up the Cape, and then across to St. Helena. This was at a time when you couldn't actually fly in there at all. The only planes that landed were RAF jets. There is, I believe, going to be... I think they've lengthened the runway a little. So there will be planes that can land there very soon. So maybe, you know, the opportunities to exile you there are increasing
by the day.
I'd rather go to Corsica or what's the other island? Alba?
We're not saying to Corsica.
St. Helena or Bust.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, Pope Francis is visiting the Shroud of Turin this week. Do you guys care about that?
I'm just trying to work out what the link is when you said speaking of.
Well, I said Corsica, Alba, and then that kind of got me into the Mediterranean, and now we're talking about
Italy.
Enough.
Okay. We'll sort of give you that
historical kind of context.
Turin Shroud.
No?
I'm kind of ambivalent, I'd say, about that.
You don't believe it?
Probably not on balance, Steve.
But... You're a raging militant atheist, so you wouldn't believe in that.
No, I'm a healthy skeptic. It's a fine line, I know, but there we are.
No, but I find it interesting, actually, because it seems like every year they carbon date the thing and they say, oh, actually, it was in the time of Christ. And then they say, no, it was a medieval kind of fabrication.
Just wrap up this segment now. See what I've done there? You like that?
I see that.
And then they get an old Spanish woman to try and repaint it.
Now that, my friend, is news.
Yeah. Didn't we send someone there too? Someone went to the
we cover all the big stories.
I think Liam Aldous went to the church,
because that little town has become very famous now. It's a big tourism
boom. Tourist attraction now.
Yeah. Maybe that could happen to Turin.
Yeah, put Turin on the map for the first time.
Yeah.
Guess what's happening on the 24th?
Is it International Day of and then something ridiculous?
No, it's not Hedgehog Awareness Week like I normally bring up, or British Tomato Week.
British Tomato Week is actually
British Tomato Week. Sorry.
Yeah. First of all. Tomato. Let's not get into pronunciations.
No.
Or pronunciations, however you say.
It's Glastonbury.
Oh, of course, Glastonbury.
I mean, it's a bit of a, you know, local news story. I mean, but it is.
No,
a...
come on. You know who's headlining Glastonbury this
Foo
year?
Foo Fighters, Kanye West, and The Who. Actually, Foo Fighters are out now. Dave Grohl broke his leg. But Kanye will still be there, I think.
Kanye, indeed. There was.
Are you going?
I'm not. I've actually got a prior engagement that weekend. But Kanye, there was this.
I don't have a prior engagement, but I'll find one.
I think you're saying Kanye wrong, too. You said Kanye.
Kanye.
How do you say it?
I think it's pronounced like Duke.
Oh, jeez.
Anyway, to go back to Kanye, there was a moment of controversy about his appearance at Glastonbury, when it was first announced that he was performing, there was a protest and people were rising up and saying, it's not right, it should be rock. And then it turned out that it was just one man who had never been to Glastonbury before who started an online petition. And yet, you know, the British media managed to string it out for 2 or 3 weeks. So that will be mentioned
because that's
on
insane.
Numerous occasions.
If you look at the lineup, I mean, everybody is going to be at Glastonbury.
There we are.
Finally, and this is actually quite cool, one of Monocle's favorite people, Massimo Bottura, he a famous Italian chef, one of your favorite people.
A culinary icon.
Yeah, no, he is. He's coming to London to open up a kind of a pop-up, I guess you could call it, in Sotheby's, London. So he's basically...
Can you do a pop-up in Sotheby's?
Yeah, he's going to do it.
As long as you don't spill anything.
In the galleries itself. It's going to be, I think, three evenings. He's going to do a 7-course tasting menu, which would be absolutely incredible if you could try to get a spot.
And this is
probably already
the moment, Danny, where you're thinking, why do I do the entrepreneurs rather than the menu?
Well,
Marcus Hippie's going to be
the business
down there
of
like
food.
A shot.
Yeah.
No. Marcus got that all sewn up. Daniel Giacopelli... With
unconventional
news look ahead, devoid of news. Thank you very much indeed.
Anytime.
It's big, handsome, and we'll spend the whole summer by your side. It's the sun-dappled July-August Quality of Life double issue, and it's waiting for you now. Here's what our editors have lined up.
In culture, we look at media at the heart of the city, visiting those cool cats at New York Magazine, Cadena Ser in Madrid, and Radio Liban in Beirut.
In the design section, we meet the Swedish firm excelling in the growing world of wooden high-rises.
In the edit section, we meet three startups improving city living in Oslo, Paris, and Hong Kong.
The July-August issue is on sale now, or make your life easier with a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the club.
As Monocle's editors and correspondents dart from city to city, they get to know the best places to rest their heads, stretch their limbs after a long flight, and kick back with a contact in a hard-to-find cocktail bar. All this information is now available in a new collection of books, Monocle's Travel Guide series, published by Gestalten. Up first, London.
This place won't ever beg for your adoration. It's just not that kind of town. But if you stick around long enough and occasionally give it your undivided attention, the city will eventually reveal what all the fuss is about. Trust us, it's worth the wait.
To celebrate the publication of our London guide, Monocle Films has produced a cinematic portrait of the city, from wild parks and lofty gardens to culinary discoveries and the best music venues. Our film journeys to our favourite places in the city we call home. London, premiering now in the film section at monocle.com.
Dr. Matthew Green is a historian with his eye focused firmly on contemporary matters. His Unreal City Audio project delivers immersive, sound-based tours of London that listeners can enjoy from anywhere on the globe, building a picture of the city around the listener. That inquisitive perspective means that Matthew is always looking for new stories and novel ways to tell the story of London, which has had no shortage of documentation during its 2,000-year history.
His search has led him to compile many of those tales in a new book, London, A Travel Guide Through Time. And he joins us now in the studio. Matthew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Good afternoon.
Now, as Tom sort of said in that introduction there, I mean, he almost pretty much said, what's the point of this, didn't you, Tom? Where he said, yeah, there's been no shortage of documentation of London during its 2,000-year history. How do you then start to tell a story of a city which has been told so many times before?
Well, it's a good question because you don't want to just fall into the trap of writing about, you know, the London city and then the fire and the plague and then the Blitz. So what I wanted to do was actually kind of turn it on its head a little bit and actually kind of take the reader by the arm and parachute them into specific years in the history of London, then take them on a kind of whirlwind tour, you know, sort of seeing the sights and soaking up the smells, like tasting the foods, writing it in the present tense and the second person as though you're actually there experiencing it. And then at the end of each chapter, you get kind of spat back into the 21st century city where you trace echoes of the past. So I wanted to make it more immersive and immediate, and I hope that's why it's different to all the countless tomes that you just referenced.
And I wonder, I mean, that is interesting, that idea about, you know, spitting people out back into the modern city and hopefully then saying, oh, wow, here's this thing that I've missed. Do you think that we Londoners are bad at noticing things? You know, there's all of this incredible legacy, and it is there if you know where to look, and this book gives you a helping hand. But do you think we should generally be better at identifying these amazing historical sort of living artifacts that are still all around us?
I think it would enrich people's weeks. Yeah, I think people are so kind of caught up in the rush of their, you know, daily commute or whatever, that we are kind of slightly oblivious to all these kind of amazing monuments around us. To give you an example, like, have you ever walked out of London Bridge Station and crossed London Bridge? Have you noticed there's a sort of tall, elegant spike made out of Portland stone without any inscriptions or anything?
I haven't actually ever noticed that.
You will have seen it,
okay.
But it blends into the cityscape because, you know, you don't really question what it's there for. But in fact, that marks the spot where the kind of traitors' heads were skewered on London Bridge. Over 300 years.
This is now right by the Shard.
Yeah, it's a bit further towards the river. But,
oh, no, I'm just saying the Shard has that same sort of shape. You could do the same thing today on the Shard if you could get the rockets atop the Shard.
I wish, yeah. You need planning permission. But yeah, the shapes, they sort of mimic one another. I don't know if that was deliberate, but I mean, it was only put there in the year 2000. But that's why. And, you know, that's like, if only you knew that when you were walking past, then that might make your kind of walk a bit more exciting.
You mentioned at the start you didn't want to do sort of the stories of London we know, like the Great Fire and the Blitz and so on. Give us an example of perhaps a sort of a relatively modern story that perhaps Londoners and people who know London don't know this about it.
Well, for example, if you go to Mead Street in Soho, which is an amazing street with kind of urban sort of Georgian townhouses, this was once the site of a place called Le Macabre, a coffee house. It was one of a kind of cluster of rock and roll espresso bars. Very few people know that it was there. There's no plaque there anymore. It's just an office today. But this was once the kind of premier kind of gothic espresso bar in the whole city. You'd go in, everyone would be dressed in pitch black. You'd have to wear dark sunglasses and you'd take your coffee on a coffin. So you'd sit on the coffin, drink a little glass of espresso, ash into candlelit skulls, and there'd be funereal music sort of wafting over from the jukebox. And this was a big thing for about 10 years. And then it kind of died without a trace as the kind of teddy boys and the mods all grew up and moved out to suburbia. But you can revisit that place if you read the fifth chapter of my book.
I love the idea that there was a premiere gothic espresso.
Yeah, it was the
flagship
actually, one.
It was like, oh, yeah. I mean, we've all been to your bog standard, you know, gothic espresso place. But, but the creme de la creme. Yeah.
Drinks just aren't served on a coffin in the other establishment.
No, they just don't go that extra mile.
and tell me about sort of going, you know, travelling around London. Obviously, you know, one of your things that you do is these sort of, you know, immersive tours. A lot of it is on foot when you are, by definition, much more sort of immediately engaged with your surroundings. Does that remain the best way to understand London? You have to hit the pavements and get walking. Or are these things that you can actually sort of dip in and out of, even if you're speeding past in a train or a car or something like that?
Well, if you've got a sedan chair, that would be preferable.
That's how I normally travel.
Do you have a monocle sedan chair? I could sort of see that.
It's been discussed at some stage.
It's a work in progress. But no, I think, if you want the fully immersive experience, then you do need to give yourself about an hour and a half. Cut off your phone, unless you're listening to our audio tour, of course. but then just, soak it up. I mean, you can dip in and dip out. You know, if you find that you're near a kind of one of these portals, as I call them, kind of portals into the past, then you can. But I think generally it's better to, just to walk through the city, because there's always a new discovery around the corner. And one of the purposes of this book is that, you know, you never knew this was there, for example, and then you sort of walk around and you see that kind of that gate in Clerkenwell, you know, St. John's Gate. You sort of walk by and you can see that it's medieval, but no one quite knows why it's there. And then it turns out that was once the kind of censorship office when kind of Shakespeare was alive. Then it became the Latin coffee house, and then it had all these other kind of uses. So just opening people's eyes really to what's around them.
How did you begin, not this project, but sort of your interest, your original interest in the London that you saw around it? What was it sparked by? Did you grow up in London?
I grew up just outside London, at the end of the Metropolitan Line, at a place called Amersham. So London was this presence that was always kind of at the end of the line, and whenever I made it down, like, it kind of blew my mind and I was always kind of obsessed with it. But it was actually because we wanted to make an app. We had this kind of like grand sort of quixotic visions of this incredibly clever app that would, you could just walk through London and it would detect what had happened, you know, around the corner, and then it would bring it to life, and, you know, it would all be kind of GPS sensitive and it would be able to read your mind and all that kind of stuff. That never quite came to fruition, but we did hit upon the idea of doing immersive tours with Unreal City Audio, whereby you might walk through Fleet Street, you might walk around kind of Dr. Johnson's London or the sites of the old chocolate houses, say, and we have actors and musicians in period dress who leap out when you least expect it and kind of sort of perform the past. So that's how I got into it. And then Penguin found me and said, would you like to write, you know, a guide to the whole of London's history in, you know, as an evolution of these kind of performative tours that you do.
Matthew, I wanted to ask you, and there's some great sort of maps and illustrations in the book as well. I just opened it at random, and there's one which is, you know, the music halls of Victorian London, late 19th century. Some of these are sort of still there today, and some of them have kind of been sort of reformed, sometimes quite authentically, other times it's a bit of a sort of ersatz version. Do you worry a bit that by sort of scraping away some of the surface, maybe that happens, you know, people look to rekindle these things, they are a bit ersatz, they're not sort of authentic? Does it worry you that it could besmirch almost the, these amazing memories and discoveries with people saying, oh, I can make a few bucks out of, you know, doing a modern music hall on the same site? Or do you think it's all good because it's referencing the past and it is again opening people's eyes?
I think generally it's all good. I mean, if someone says, I'm going to start a music hall and it's just, I know, in someone's kitchen and people getting drunk, obviously that would be a bit lackluster. But if they do it properly...
It doesn't sound that bad.
I guess that would be more like a song and supper club that they used to have, and you'd get drunk and throw the chops at the kind of performers and stuff. Wilton's music hall springs to mind in this discussion. And that, I mean, that has been restored almost perfectly. So there are some examples. But yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to be a slave to the kind of historical authenticity of it. I mean, music hall is much of an idea and a genre, and, you know, just the idea of kind of variety that you still get today in certain places. And, you know, like the idea of a tobacco house. You know, we see lots of vape bars popping up over London at the moment, and that taps into this sort of Jacobean tradition of these places where you'd go and just smoke as much as you possibly could because you thought it was a catalyst for creativity. And in those days, they thought smoking was really good for your health, especially if you were pregnant, weirdly.
they were so close.
They were so close, yeah. There were a few people that were like, hang on a minute, you know, I've dissected a tobacconist, as they used to call them, and his insides looked like a kind of interior of a chimney, but they were kind of ignored.
Science, no.
Yeah, there was not much space for that, yeah. So I'm all in favour of people bringing it back because, yeah, it's going to stimulate interest, and if it's not done 100% accurately, you know, historical films are not, they don't have to be completely accurate because you also need the story and the experience to work. And my book is grounded in historical fact, but because there's that time travel dimension, you do actually travel back and you meet people, you have a conversation with the Elephant Man, you know, you walk through the bomb sites of the Blitz, you know, you walk around the medieval city when it's under curfew late at night, the kind of monastic belt that used to surround London. So there's a bit of room for artistic license in that, and I think if it brings it to life, and as long as you don't do kind of undue violence to the historical truth, so to speak, then yeah, bring it on.
All cities have to change to survive and thrive, and London is perhaps a prime example of that. And we're going through this sort of period of change right now, which certainly for those of us who are in it feels quite dramatic. Areas that were, you know, very, very different 10 years ago have now changed beyond all recognition.
Yeah.
Do you worry about some of the changes that are taking place in London right now? Or do you think this is just a natural evolution every city goes through at different stages?
I agree with both parts of what you said, actually. I think one thing that you take away from the history of London, having just written a book about it, is that areas are always in flux. You take somewhere like Covent Garden, when that was built, that was the kind of acme of sophistication. You couldn't get a more fashionable place in Europe. But then you move on 40 years, and it's a kind of opium-fueled bohemia full of brothels and jelly houses where you go and watch women eat jelly for your titillation, that kind of thing. And then it changed again, and now it's sort of a tourist trap. So they do change, and it would be foolish to try and put a force field around it and say, like, this area must stay the same. So I'm in favour of them evolving organically. But what I do worry about is what's happening to central London. I think areas like Fitzrovia, no doubt areas like Marylebone, probably Soho, seem, because the rental prices and the property prices are so high, a lot of them are becoming hollowed out and becoming kind of enclaves of oligarchs and whatnot. And I think that's killing some of the vibrancy of those areas in a way that you don't see so much with a kind of natural evolution. And it's, in a way, it's good because it's pushing people out further and further out. So it's actually rejuvenating places like Seven Sisters and Walthamstow. But before long, you know, those people are going to be pushed all the way out. So they're not even in London anymore. And I wouldn't
Back in Amersham.
They'll be back in Amersham, yeah. I don't think they would be after London. But you don't want a situation where London becomes like Zurich, for example, where you can only afford to live there if you're a kind of high-flying financier. Got nothing against high-flying financiers, but, you know, maybe they should give some houses away to artists in Fitzrovia.
Nothing too idealistic there. Matthew, you're obviously sort of, you know, passionate, you said, about London. It's rooted in your experience from growing up in Amersham, coming to the city. Now you've been documenting it. You sort of live and work amongst it. Do you think you could translate that passion to another city? You know, could we see, you know, Paris, a travel guide, other cities with rich history? Or is there, do you think, something just uniquely appealing for whatever reason about London that will sort of retain your focus, at least for the time being?
Well, I think, yeah, I find London uniquely fascinating and kind of euphoric to walk around. But that said, I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life studying it and writing about it. I would love to write a travel guide to New York or Paris, one of those other cities. I think it would work really well for a different city. I think it would be harder to do it for a whole country because that would be a kind of limitless task. So I'm going to go on doing the tours and talks all over London, but I think my next writing project would be something with more of a global focus.
Exciting.
There we are. And we'll have you back in then, if not before.
Is that some kind of an exclusive? I don't know.
Could be.
Matthew Green, thank you very much indeed. The book is London, A Travel Guide Through Time. It's out now. Buy it.
Well, Steve, we've been talking about London's history, and very enjoyable it's been too. But how about some sounds of the future?
Why not?
Here's some newly minted, rather sophisticated pop from London duo Rainer. This is Nocturne.
That was Nocturne from the London-based duo Rainer. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like Hindbrook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
As the diplomatic wrangle over the Arctic continues, Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis travelled to the Arctic Council's meeting in northern Canada to assess, on film, the path ahead for this strategically important area.
The Arctic Council is often held up as an example of how an international diplomatic body should operate. It has a strong track record of resolving territorial disputes peacefully and dealing with the shifting Arctic landscape in all its forms through measured negotiation.
Circle of Friends, the art of Arctic diplomacy, a Monocle movie, now premiering in the film section of monocle.com.
The rise and rise of capitalism throughout history shows no sign of slowing, and when compared to disastrous social experiments, Soviet Russia during the 20th century, the freedom to choose, buy and spend whatever we like certainly seems to be the model that keeps the masses most happy. But the capitalist system has its faults, of course, inequality, poverty and environmental damage being just some of its rather unpleasant side effects.
These have led Austrian publisher and activist Christian Felber to devise a different system, one that places the public's well-being and quality of life at the forefront of its agenda. He calls it the economy of the common good, and his ideas have been adopted by over 1,700 companies across the globe. Now being published for the first time in English, Felber's ideas are detailed in his new book, Change Everything, and he joined Monocle's Tom Hall a little earlier to talk about it.
Original version came out in 2010 in Austria. And in the same year, a movement started with, in the beginning, a dozen of entrepreneurs. And in the 5 years since then, it has spread to 40 countries on all continents. More than 2,000 businesses are supporting the model. And the book has been translated into 9 languages. And it's a question of the interest of a publisher that it has now been published in UK. But there has already been a big event at Westminster Palace with 40 British organizations involved, which show a great interest in changing the economic model towards an economy for the common good.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, and there's that phrase there, which is kind of the crux of this, the economy for the common good. Tell people a little bit about what that means, because I think perhaps maybe some listeners would be wary of, we can speak very broadly about capitalism, we can talk about socialism, and they both have their sort of evils, if you will. Capitalism can be very exploitative, and socialism, we've seen, can go very wrong, as seen in Soviet Russia. Why do you think people should now be listening to perhaps this middle way? What is it that you're trying to communicate?
Because exactly, they are becoming aware that both extremes failed. Communism failed very clearly, did not bring the freedom that they promised, and capitalism as well is failing. In Germany and Austria, 90% of the population are asking, according to very serious opinion and repeated opinion polls, for a different economic order, which shall be a market economy. So a free economy is asked for, but it shall be an ethical economy, respecting fundamental values like dignity, justice, solidarity, sustainability, and democracy. And the most important change is, on a first glance, a very small change, but it is the clarity about the goal of the economy. And at the moment, the accumulation of capital or the increase of money is the highest goal of the economic activity. We measure it on all levels with return on investment, financial return, financial profit of a company, or the GDP. But if we look at constitutions of democratic countries, and Great Britain is an exception because it doesn't have such a constitution, all of these tell us that the goal of the economic activity shall be the common good already today. And what we are trying to say that if this is the goal and if people agree with it, what we would ask before, then we shall measure at the moment of economic success measurement the achievement of the goal. That's why I have developed a common good product and a common good balance sheet and a common good exam for investments to put in line success measurement in the economy with the goal.
And it's a very practical thing as well, because, I mean, this has been adopted by over 1,700 companies, is that correct?
Yeah, 1,850 companies are supporting the initiative, and 250 of them have already implemented the core instrument, the Common Good Balance Sheet, until its final stage.
And have companies been very enthusiastic about it? What incentive is it for a company to ensure that, say, the quality of life? I mean, obviously, I understand in a very real sense, quality of life is very good, but for in a financial sense, maybe, why should a company feel that they will get more out of their people by ensuring that those sort of standards are the priority?
We have asked for feedback, our pioneer companies, and they gave us 7 main headlines, from the most intrinsic motives to the most extrinsic motives. And the first and strongest answer was meaning. Finally, they find meaning in doing business and doing good for society. Then there are other motives like working together with other companies who also want to do good for society, to find ethical labor force, to find ethical clients. And the most extrinsic ones are that this is a whole macroeconomic model. And in the end, the ethical performance and the ethical achievement of companies shall be rewarded thanks to lower taxes, lower tariffs, better loan conditions, or priority in public procurement. And these are very strong incentives for companies to become more ethical.
Tell us a little bit about how you kind of arrived at this. I mean, what's your journey before you sort of came upon this idea? Did you have particular experience where you felt that you were being failed by perhaps society as a wider model? How did you arrive at that idea?
Well, the most personal experience was a personal and individual discomfort with the way the global economy is developing, and especially financial markets. That's why I already founded another association and social movement 15 years ago, which now has 7,000 paying members in Austria, but which I left because the economy for the common good is growing even faster and it needs all my energy. And the initial sparkle was the recognition that we are mixing up goals and means in the economy. Money and capital are very valuable means, but they're not the goal of the economy. And I figured it out at the moment of seeing that success is not measured alongside the achievement of life quality, a good life, a common good, or happiness, which according to not only scientific research, but it was already Aristotle who said money is an important means for the economy, but the goal is the good life. And now, after having experimented capitalism, where the accumulation of capital is the goal of the economic activity of a company or of an investment, and having experienced a centrally planned anti-democratic economy, we can go one step further beyond these extremes and put into balance individual freedom, which is a free market economy, which is the economy for the common good, and the social values like justice, solidarity, cooperation, or democracy. And this is not a contradiction any longer. It's an integration. And we found a way to implement this integration. And that's why so many companies and even banks and stock markets are participating.
So all the way back from Aristotle to the present day, Christian Velber carrying the common good and the ideas for the common good. Thank you very much for joining us on Monocle. I appreciate you sort of telling us the nucleus of that idea, and hopefully it will spread and people can learn more about it and it will kind of find more and more takers across the world. Christian, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and you're warmly welcome to join the movement in UK.
Thank you.
That was Christian Velber talking to our very own Tom Hall a little earlier. You're listening to The Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Now, in a moment, Steve, we'll be speaking to Monocle's woman in Helsinki about how light illuminates a city with no shortage of bright ideas. But first, let's have a song from the region. This is the Helsinki band KXP with Space Precious Time.
And that was KXP with Space Precious Time. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards. We'll be in Helsinki right after this.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Markus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
It was designed by a suspect bohemian, houses a coup plotter, and today is favoured by young liberal creatives. Madrid's Edificio Princesa is a concrete testament to the contradictions of Spain's transition to democracy, as our correspondent Liam Aldiss discovered.
Today, the building that was once dubbed the bunker by Madrileños is now seen in a very different light, as plant life has progressively engulfed the structure, fulfilling the architect's original vision and providing residents with plenty of verdant balconies. Edificio Princesa is being celebrated as a model of inner-city, high-density architecture that has withstood the test of time.
On the home front, a photographic portrait, now playing in the film section at monocle.com.
Katja Pantsar is Monocle's contributor in Helsinki. We're often speaking to her about the latest political goings-on, or perhaps she's updating us on her home city's exceptional quality of life. But as with many of our Monocle contributors, they're a talented bunch. Katja has other projects on the burn, such as a new book written about the role that light plays in the Finnish capital.
Yes, light. It's about as intangible as a subject could possibly be, but Katja has managed to pin it down, she hopes, in Helsinki by Light, a new book looking at both that ethereal natural aura that surrounds us all, as well as some of the novel industrial uses for it in the Finnish capital. And she joins us on the line now from Helsinki. Katja, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. I've been to Helsinki in winter, and it's a dark, gloomy place, and you sometimes sort of think, God, how on earth can anyone, why is this city so good? I don't quite understand it. And then you return in spring or summer and it's like a completely different place. How important does a role does light play in how you see your home?
I think that it plays a massive role, and I think that's how my obsession with light came about. I moved from Toronto to Helsinki over 10 years ago, and I almost immediately became obsessed with the light, partly because, yes, in the winter months, it's a scarce commodity, whereas in the summer, we have endless 24 hours of light. And I noticed that people behave completely differently in the summertime. They're happy, they wear bright colors, they're social, and in the winter, they wear dark clothes, and they're not so social and not so friendly. And I started to basically look into it more and pay more attention to lighting design, lighting festivals that take place in the wintertime in an effort, I think, to brighten up the mood and look at how a lot of the, for example, bright light therapy lamps and all of these things, how they affect people, but also how living in a place with such great extremes has affected design. Kiasma, our modern museum of art, or contemporary art, I should say, was built by an American, Stephen Hall, or I should say designed by an American architect. And he basically says that light was the sole building block because he too became so obsessed with the quality of light and the extremes of light in Helsinki.
And Katja, it's interesting, isn't it? There's a certain acclamation for the Finnish design, you know, Finnish design mantras, the Finnish design culture. And one of the things that's important, and this is reflected in the book, is the use of light. You've already mentioned it there, how architects in particular use that light as this natural building block, as you describe it. Do you think it's an appreciation of light, perhaps because it's scarce at some times of year and because it's so abundant in others, that has kind of made Finnish design so special and so well regarded?
I definitely think that that's the case. Part of the inspiration for this book also came from this realization. I grew up largely in Canada, and years ago, I was sitting in the Vancouver Art Gallery Cafe. I had just seen an excellent exhibition. I think it was Georgia O'Keeffe. And then I went into the cafe, and there was fluorescent lighting. And I thought, isn't that strange that, you know, they've put all this effort into lighting up the gallery and the art, and then the people get to sit in these fluorescent lights. And that was part of my realization that, wow, in Finland, this would not happen. You know, in cafes and a lot of public spaces, there's a real real focus on the type of light, how it's used, the effect that it has on people. For example, in a lot of parks are lit at night, which is not done in other parts of the world, and especially during the winter months. Of course, they don't need to be lit in the summer months because it's light out. And that is because there's a connection between how active people are and what they do when there's good lighting.
And of course, Katja, Finland as a country is known as one of the many homes for the northern lights. And if you're very lucky, it just about gets as far south as Helsinki. How important is light to the psyche, the Finnish psyche?
I think it's huge. I really think that there are a lot of people who suffer in the winter months, and this what I referred to earlier, the two different kinds of Finns, you know, the happy summer Finns and the more somber, serious winter Finns. I do think that it affects people, and it has been studied, and a lot of people do suffer from seasonal affective disorder, you know, when there's up to 18 hours of darkness in the winter months. It does make people lethargic, and some people get depressed. You know, there are a host of symptoms that people can have when there's a lack of natural light.
Katja, I wanted to ask you about the transition you've made. You mentioned it already, the fact that you moved from Canada to Finland. Obviously, you were a Torontonian, but, you know, within Canada, there is parts of the country which are sort of, you know, deal with some of these issues about, you know, scarcity of light in the winter and a prevalence of it in the summertime. Do you think there are national differences? And were you additionally aware of this when you were researching the book, between how different countries deal with those challenges? Or do you think that there weren't really sort of stereotypes that it played up to?
I think there's a greater awareness in the Nordic countries because of the extremes. But I must confess that I haven't spent time in Arctic Canada, for example. I've been in the cities, Vancouver, Toronto. So I haven't, you know, the same phenomenon exists when you go way up north in Canada, where there is not that much light in the wintertime and much more light in the summertime. But on a design level, I don't think, at least in the cities, that I saw the same focus on light that I've experienced in Helsinki and in Finland. And of course, I think it's because the extremes are not there, you know, in the big cities. And it's one of those things when you're forced to deal with something, and I think especially Finns are very innovative. And so it's like, okay, let's turn this around and let's make great lighting and design lamps and light festivals and do all sorts of things, rather than just be in the dark, as it were.
What do you think the lessons are for other cities that perhaps haven't embraced the differences in light and the challenges of light as well as Helsinki has?
I think one thing that always surprises me is, for example, reflectors are a Finnish invention. And the fact that they're not really used in other parts of the world. In the Nordics, they are. But, you know, it's just as dark in New York, 5 or 6 p.m. On a fall, or let's say a winter evening, when you're crossing a busy intersection and, you know, people are dressed in black and maybe they're not even crossing at the lights. It always surprises me that kind of, I guess, the lack of awareness of light and of how, I do think, of course, in cities, big cities like New York, there's a lot of fabulous lighting design. But I think on a kind of a personal level about selecting lamps and reflectors and the awareness of things like, okay, if you light up parks or dark spaces, you can really influence the way people feel.
The illuminating, if you'll forgive the pun, insights of Katja Pantsa. The book is Helsinki by Light, published by Siltala Publishing out of Helsinki. Katja, thanks very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
So there we are, another Monocle Weekly wrapped up, Tom. And I must say, I feel like going for a bit of a stroll around London now.
100%. And it was interesting, there were sort of themes that ran through that. We kicked off talking a little bit about quality of life in great cities of the world, and then we delved into London. We talked about quality of life as it relates to economic systems, and then we talked about Helsinki, which is on the list as well. So there was
almost
sort of a theme.
There were a producer working on this program who had an overarching vision for what the programme should be, and then delivered
almost,
it.
Almost, Steve, almost. Almost.
The one problem, of course, with this 500-page hardback book by Dr. Matthew Green is that...
Portability.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you just get the old audiobook going.
I know. But, you know, if I want to sort of wander out now into Marylebone and flick through and go, oh, let's look at this from 1665. Anyway, I'm just saying.
You can do that.
I can.
Just tear the pages out.
Just
don't tell Dr. Matthew that.
No, you can't do that at all. I believe that Rob and Andrew will be both safely back. Well, one assumes Rob will be back safely from Chiang Mai.
I'm sure he will.
In one piece. And he and Andrew will be here with the Monocle Weekly next week. All we have time to do now is thank the producer, Tom Hall, the researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and the studio manager, Claire Aban. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, goodbye from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.